Okay, good morning, everybody. It's so nice to be here. It's so nice to see faces that I haven't seen in so long. So nice to be together learning in person. My name is Tamar Shamas, and I'm very excited and honored to be giving this year today. With your permission, I would like to dedicate our learning to a good friend, Anita Refua Shalema, Hirsch Yaakov Ben Chayalea. So our learning should be dedicated in honor of a Refua Shalema for him. In my daytime job, I talk to teachers about being engaging and not just talking at people, but trying to make lessons interactive. So I'm going to try to practice what I preach and make this less of a frontal share and more of an interactive learning experience. So I hope that that is okay with everybody here. And if you don't want to talk, you don't need to talk, but I will give opportunities to think and reflect, and I would also love to hear from all of you. So if you're looking for the source sheet in your folders, this year is called The Mothers of Geula, and it looks something like this. And if anybody needs one, I have an extra one. Okay, so I'm going to start with a story. The Lubavitcher Rebbe, Zichrono Tzadik Levracha, towards the middle to end of his life, suffered several rounds of heart attacks. And it's really interesting. We live on Sleeping Bear and have the schluss of living close to Dr. Weiss, who was the Rebbe's cardiologist and used to fly back and forth from Chicago to take care of him. And he tells fascinating stories. I'm not sure if he told the story, although in the vein of Emma's shir on B'Shem Omro, I'm not exactly sure where this story is from, but it is not my own original story. In 1977, the Rebbe suffered a serious heart attack. And the following day, the Rebbe insisted that he wanted to give one of his sichos to his chassidim, as he had done on that same day for the previous 38 years. So a few days later, the doctor asked, "How is the Rebbe feeling?" The Rebbe replied, "Physically, thank God, I feel fine, but mentally not so well." He explained that he wasn't feeling so well, not because he had just suffered a heart attack, but because he had not been able to visit the kever of his father-in-law, as he was accustomed to doing several times a month. So the doctor said to him, and I think it was Dr. Weiss, said to him, "You have to take care of your health. If not, there's a 25% chance of a relapse." The doctor asked the Rebbe if he understood his warning, like 25% chance that if you don't take care of yourself, you're going to relapse. "Oh yes," answered the Rebbe with a smile. "You said that even if I don't take care of myself, which I assure you I will, there is a 75% chance that there won't be a relapse." So that was very much epitomized the Lubavitcher Rebbe, who stood very much for optimism and seeing the good. And what we're going to talk today about is two women very much related to the Geula, and one characteristic, that of optimism, having hope, having an ayin tov, seeing the good even in difficult situations. And what I would like to hopefully suggest is that this midah of optimism is one which will hopefully help lead us to Geula, and more specifically, that this is a character trait or a midah that is a birthright of us as Jewish women. So with that, we're going to delve into the sources and look at two of these women. The first woman that we're going to talk about is Nitzavet Bat Adael. Does anyone know who Nitzavet was? I think we learned about this together, me and you. Yeah, so you have all the answers already. I apologize. Nitzavet was the mother of HaMelech David. And it sounds strange that, like, HaMelech David, right? The forebearer of Mashiach. And we don't really know much about his mom. So today we're going to learn as much as I think there is to know about his mom. And again, B'Shem Omro, this comes from a midrash that I got from Chabad.org. Not everything you learn about will be Lubavitch related. It just happens to be that my first two sources are that. And I don't know much else. I'm curious to learn more if anyone has learned more about Nitzavet, read things about her. But as far as my limited research goes, there isn't much information. But we'll talk about what we do know about her. So I'm going to ask you to look at source number one, which is Psalm 69, Samach Tet, from Tehillim. Read it to yourselves for a minute or two. And as you read it, I want you to think about, first of all, whose voice is this? Like, who's talking? And what are the feelings that are associated with this mizmor? Like, what kind of feelings do you get when you read this? And what experiences do you think lead to the intensity of these emotions? So take a minute to read it, and then I'll ask you for your thoughts. A toughie? Or someone who's experienced a tough time? Oh, I'm sorry, I misheard you. What did you say?
No, Kentucky is separate.
Kentucky. I thought you said a Tuffy. Oh, I'm sorry.
Mm-hmm. Listen to your servant. Mm-hmm. So this is very much like...
Right. So it is obviously the voice of David HaMelech, and he's actually talking about something very personal here. First of all, what are the feelings that he's conveying in this mizmor? How's he feeling?
Lonely.
Lonely, rejected.
Depressed.
What's that?
Depressed.
Right? Anyone have a sense or understanding of what's leading to these feelings, specifically in this mizmor?
It was a despair. I think the verse number 3, and he describes in details how he's sinking into slimy deep and there is no food.
Yes.
He's out of the watery depths and the blood sweeps him away. It's a very detailed description, and it's like this utter despair.
Mm-hmm.
And
I said we're talking about optimism today, and I'm bringing you something that does seem so despairing. If you look at, I want to kind of... Oh, she said that she was focusing on... I'm sorry, can you please remind me your name?
Diana
was looking at Pasuk Gimel, at the third verse, and talking about it sounds like David is in such deep despair as he describes sinking into the slimy deep and finding no foothold, like he's drowning. Yeah, Marissa.
I said after the sin with Bathsheba.
Okay, very good guess. Marissa asked if it was after the sin with Bathsheba. I want to focus in on Pasuk Tet, and maybe that will help us have a better understanding of where this comes from. So in Pasuk Tet, he says, Muzar hayiti la'achi, I was like a stranger to my brothers, benochrai livnei imi, and an alien to my kin. So he's talking here about being disconnected from family. Yeah, go ahead. Before he was the king, exactly. So the question is, what had he done specifically with his brothers? This is related to his feelings and his relationships with his brothers. What had he done to arouse such ire and contempt? Was there no one who provided him with love, comfort? You know, I have kids. I know that sometimes they argue, but I would hope that none of them would say about each other that they are, what does he say? That they're an alien to each other, right? A stranger to my brothers. They don't feel that way. So what's going on here? Yeah. Right. So we're going to talk exactly about that, about what happened leading up to this that made him feel so disconnected, so hated by his brothers. So we know that David HaMelech was born into the illustrious family of Yishai, right? And Yishai served as the head of the Sanhedrin at the time, as the head of the court of the Torah law, and that Yishai, of course, was one of the distinguished leaders of his generations, and that Yishai came from Ruth HaMoabiyah, from Ruth the convert. Okay, David was the youngest in his family, and he had 7 older, illustrious, and charismatic brothers. Yet when David was born, for some reason, his birth was greeted with this derision, with this upsetness. People were not happy about the fact that David was born. And the really only person that understood David's pain, David's kind of just lack of acceptance in the world, was his mother. So first of all, how do we know that Nitzavet was his mother? So I brought you the source. It comes from a Gemara in Bava Batra in source number 2. Very simple. Imeha de David Nitzavet bat Adael Shma. The mother of David was named Nitzavet bat Adael. That's about all we get in terms of a textual example or textual reference to who his mother was. So we have to kind of look into the Midrash to fill in the gaps and understand what the story about her was. Nitzavet was really powerless to stop what was going on with David. She kind of had to stand by the sidelines and watch what was happening. And we know as mothers that, you know, as much as they tell us when our kids fight, we're supposed to let them figure it out. If a kid is being picked on, we feel bad. And, you know, some of the time, at least me, I get involved because I don't want my kid to be picked on. So she couldn't do anything. She had to stand by and not do anything. And we have to ask the question of, like, why? Why couldn't she get involved? So here's the Midrash. Here's the story behind. So we know that David's father was Yishai, as we said. And at a certain point in his life, Yishai had this like midlife crisis where he started to doubt his lineage. And he was concerned about the fact that perhaps maybe Ruth's conversion was not legitimate, which means that perhaps he was not legitimately Jewish. And he said, you know what? I need to separate from my wife. Nitzavid and I need to take a break. We need to separate. We need to divorce, because if there's any question that I'm not Jewish, then I don't want to be married to her. So he separated from his wife, and after a certain amount, and by the way, sorry, I should say that his children were aware of this separation. At this point, David was not yet born. He separated from his wife, Nitzavet, and his seven boys were aware of this separation. After a number of years had passed, the Midrash explains, Yishai longed for a child whose ancestry would be unquestionable, and as a result, he decided to engage in a relationship with a Canaanite maidservant, right? No question. If I'm not Jewish, she's not Jewish, no question, this won't be a problem. And he explained to her the situation and said that he was going to take this maidservant. The maidservant, I don't know what her name was, but she was a very empathetic person, and she saw what this was doing to Nitzavet, you know, that her husband separated from her, he was no longer with her. It wasn't because there were any issues between them, but simply because he was worried about his lineage. And the maidservant said to Nitzavet, hey, let's pull a Rachel Leah situation. Let's switch. Right? He really is for all intents and purposes, your husband. Let you have the child with him, and let's do things that way. Nitzavet agreed to it, but there was no one else that knew about this little plan that was taking place. So they did this, and after 3 months, Nitzavet's pregnancy began to show. So what do you think all her sons are going to think? Right, that she is pregnant with a very illegitimate child because she had separated from Yishai. She wasn't with Yishai, and now she's pregnant. But Nitzavet, for her part, left much like the story with Yehuda and Tamar. Tamar did not want to embarrass Yehuda. Nitzavet felt the same way towards Yishai, and she said, I'm not going to say anything. I'm not going to tell them that this is actually their father's child, and I'm not going to embarrass Yishai in that way either. So she made a very selfless and difficult decision, because obviously people are going to look at her with contempt and they're not going to be such a big fan of the child that's born. And the child that's born 9 months later is none other than David. So now we have a little bit of a better understanding as to why the brothers felt such animosity, right, and such hatred and contempt toward their brother, towards who they assumed was their, if it's from the mother, it's a step or half, I don't know. Half, who they assumed was a half-brother from some random man that wasn't their father. Unaware of the truth behind his wife's pregnancy, but really having compassion on her, Yishai ordered his sons not to touch her. Don't kill her, let her have this child, even though his status is questionable and he will be illegitimate. We're not going to harm him in any way, right? We're not going to accept him, but we're not going to harm him. And from that time on, Nitzavet's son was treated by his brothers and as an abominable outcast. Noting the conduct of his brothers, the community also assumed that this youth was a treacherous sinner full of unspeakable guilt. Maybe that helps us better understand some of the depression that David always seemed to be in, because, you know, it all starts at home, and if this is what home life is like, perhaps that influences his outlook on life in general. Yes, I see a hand.
All of this is found
from Basra. No.
So where is this?
So this was from a midrash that I had on from Chabad.org, and I still do not know where the original source of the midrash is from. I'm still looking for it. I don't know. If anybody does know it, please offer it. I'm not 100% sure. If I did, I would say it. I can share the article with you. Yeah, that has all the information, absolutely. Okay, so fast forward 28 years. David is, you know, kind of semi a part of his family, even though he's not fully accepted in his family. And if you look in source number 3, we know there came a time when King Shaul sent the prophet Shmuel to go and anoint a new king. Right, and if you look in source number 3, it says, "Vekarata leYishai bezevach vaAnochi odiacha et asher taaseh umashachta li et asher omari lecha." So Shaul sends Shmuel and says, "Go to Yishai, right, to the special feast that they're having, and when you're there, I'll let you know who the one is that you should make the king." Okay, so Shmuel goes to the house of Yishai. He sees all these boys gathered around the table, and he's looking at them, and he kind of has the nevuah to know. No, it's not any of you. So at a certain point, Shmuel says to Yishai, Is there anyone left? Source number four. Vayomer Shmuel Yishai, Hatamu Hanearim, right? Are these all the boys that you have? Vayomer Ochar Hakatan, Vihinero Ebatzon. He says, oh no, there's like another one, but he's like out tending the sheep. You know, it kind of reminds me of the Cinderella story where she's like the disregarded, rejected one. He's out in the field with the sheep. Vayomer Shmuel Yishai, Shilcha Vakachuni, Ki Lona Sov Ad Bopo. Like Shmuel said to Yishai, go get him because we're not going to sit down to eat until he gets here. I want to see this one. Okay? So the Midrash fills in the gaps here and says that David was summoned from the fields and he went home to change, and Nitzavet in her quiet background is finally like, the moment has come, right? She was quiet for 28 years. She said nothing because she didn't want anything to be revealed. She did not want to embarrass her ex-husband. She said nothing. And now the time has come where the truth will be revealed. And not only will the truth be revealed, but her son, who she always knew was so wonderful and so great and didn't deserve any of the treatment that he was getting, that he would be elevated to this higher level of king. Whether she had nevuah or not, I'm not sure. She's not considered one of the Sheva Neviot, but she knew in her heart, like mothers know in their hearts, that something better was destined for her son. Marissa.
I also feel like even without that story,
yeah,
you can kind of understand the animosity that the brothers would have had, because they're, you know, the brother who is perceived to be unworthy of this task,
yeah,
you know, is the one anointed.
Right, 100%, absolutely. So it says, we're still in source number four, Pasuk Yudbet, Vaishlach Vaviehu Vihu Admoni Im Yafe Einayim V'Tov Ro'i. Right, we know about King David that he comes and the Navi describes him as ruddy cheeked, really like a redhead, and bright eyed and handsome. Vayomer Hashem Kum Meshichehu Kizehu. And Shmuel got the nevuah that said, stand up, this is him, this is your guy, this is the one who we're going to make king. And the Radak has an interesting commentary on how this whole process took place. If you look in source number 5, Radak asks the question, "Valama lo amar lo mitchila shimashech David?" Right? Like, why didn't Shmuel just come in and say, okay, the one who's outside, that shepherd, that redhead, that's the one who's going to be the king. Go get him. Like, why was there this whole elaborate process of going through the 7 and then saying it's not him? Is there anybody else? And the Radak says, "Kidei shiyudu kulam ki mehashem hu," so that everybody would know that it's not just like, you know, eeny, meeny, miny, mo, but this one is from Hashem. Ve'iru kulam ki lo bachar b'chol b'nei Yishai, that Hashem did not just choose any of b'nei Yishai, ela b'David, ki b'pnei kol ha'omdim sham ne'emar lo al pi ha'nevuah. It was in front of all the people that were standing there that Shmuel delivered the message that this was the one who was going to be made crowned king. It's almost like the brothers need to be there to witness it, right? Because if they weren't there, they wouldn't believe it. They'd say he was making it up. They'd make fun of him. Who knows what? But the Radak suggests that there needed all this pomp and circumstance surrounding the anointment, right? Or the decision of David being the king, so that the brothers could see what was happening. So how does Nitzavet fit into all of this, right? If we think about Nitzavet, we think about the fact that she had to be brave and she had to be courageous and she had to be strong. And overall, what I want to suggest is that she had to be optimistic, because to watch her son live that way for 28 years without saying anything, without getting involved, without doing anything, she had to believe that something better was coming. She had to believe that it was going to be okay. And that's kind of the first woman who we see this birthright of nevuah coming from. She had to follow her inner convictions. She had to display patience. She had to know, and she had to pass that on to David too. She had to pass on to David the fact that despite the harsh life that he was living, despite the harshness that he was receiving from the brothers around him, from his, not father, from Yishai, I guess, from who was his father, but didn't think he was his father, that rather than be shunned by his tormentors, they had to stand proud and dignified. And we see that about David too, as someone mentioned. So much of Sefer Tehillim is about David feeling rejected and tormented, not only by his brothers, but by enemies as well. And ultimately, we know that David HaMelech found consolation in communicating with Hashem via Sefer Tehillim that he wrote. And this was something that was given to him by his mother. She demonstrated to him the necessity of boldness while pursuing the right path, that even when it's difficult and that even when it's hard, we have to remain optimistic because we believe, even though we don't know when it will happen, we believe that something good is to come. So that's Nitzavet. So let's put the Nitzavet story on the one hand, and now we're going to look at another woman who also has this idea of expressing optimism in times of difficulty and uncertainty. I forgot one source, which I want to share. This is a source that we say in Davening and Hallel, which really kind of puts together this whole idea about David. If you look in source number 6, it says, Evan Masu Habonim Haitala Rosh Pina. The stone that the builders rejected has become the chief cornerstone. That's talking about King David, that he was the one that was rejected, but ultimately he became the cornerstone. He became the Melech David. So when you say it next time in Hallel, you can think about the fact that that's about King David. So now let's turn to a different woman. We're going to turn to Huldah. Anybody heard of Huldah? Yes. Well, she's a little bit more known, but perhaps not super known. The reason I actually came upon Nitzavet and Huldah to begin is because a few years back, some of you will probably remember this, we did a series in Neely called Hidden Figures in the Torah. And we talked about hidden figures in Chumash and hidden figures in Nach and hidden figures in Gemara. Not that they're hidden figures, they're all known women. But, you know, as we talk about the women in the Torah, we talk about the ones we know well, and then there's ones that we know less well. So when I was doing my learning, then I stumbled upon Nitzavet, who I really knew not much about, and Huldah, who's actually one of the Sheva Neviot, who I personally did not know a lot about. So if you know more, then I'm happy for you to share as well. So what do you know about Huldah? Nothing. Nothing. Okay, that makes me feel better. Yeah.
If I remember correctly,
Exactly. Very good. Yes.
And she would be the woman who would go to her. And
yes.
She would be in the marketplace.
Yes. Yes. Yeah. You're giving us a preview about all the things we're going to talk about. Exactly. Yes. Absolutely. So let's do a little bit of historical background on the time period in which she lived. So we know that when Bnei Israel entered Eretz Israel, there was the time of the Nevi'im, right? We just talked about the time of the Nevi'im, and then we segued into the time of the Malachim, right? So we know that King David's son, King Shlomo, King Solomon, was the king who built the first temple, the first Beit HaMikdash, and then there were kings who ruled after him. Huldah lived in the time of the reign of King Hosea or Hoshiyahu in Yerushalayim during the era of the first Beit HaMikdash. Hoshea was only 8 years old when he inherited the crown from his father Amon. Okay, this brings us back to Malachim classes in high school. In fact, some of these were not even touched. I did not learn about this in high school. I don't know if you did. So the story goes that Hoshea's father had turned to Avodah Zarah. He had turned to idolatry, and he was murdered in a plot by his palace servants after he ruled for 2 years. So Amon was killed, and then 8-year-old Hoshea became the king. And Hoshea was really a beacon of hope in a very difficult era. There were constant enemies trying to destroy the Jewish people. The Jewish people were assimilating. It wasn't the best time in the history of the Jewish people. So we see in source number 7, in Megillah Masachet Yodalet Amud Aleph, that there were Sheva Neviot. Sheva Neviot Me'ayin Ninayhu, who were they? Sarah, Miriam, Devorah, Hannah, Abigail, Huldah, and Esther. So when you look at that list, I would probably say that most of them sound familiar, and Huldah's the one that sticks out a little bit, as we don't know as much. Does anyone else feel that way? That's what I felt when I looked at that list. I felt like in my Jewish education, we skimmed the surface on most of these, but I never really learned a lot about Huldah. Yeah?
I don't feel like I know a lot about Guile either. I don't know if that's just me.
What do other people feel? Maybe that will be our next year.
Oops. I'll be honest, I cannot even recall what
Yes. Yes, exactly. But there, and she was in Nivea too. Again, her storyline is not so big. But I'm purely talking from personal experience. When I read this, I was like, okay, Abigail, time of David. I don't know a ton about her, but at least I'd heard of her. Huldah, I really knew nothing about when I first started to learn about this. But yeah, for the most part, the other ones are somewhat more recognizable, familiar, especially the first one, Sarah, Miriam, Devorah. Huldah, a little bit less known. Okay, so Huldah's place of prophecy. What's your name, by the way?
Me?
Yes?
Annalise.
Annalise?
Yeah, I know. It sounds like the first name.
I thought it was Annalise. Anna.
I should just become an analyst. And everyone has
a great time. You might. Anna's easy. As Anna mentioned, Huldah was a Nevi'ah, and she lived during the time of two other Nevi'im, Yirmiyahu and Zephaniah. And Huldah had a place of prophecy in Yerushalayim between the temple's two southern and busiest gates. And actually, when the Beis HaMikdash was rebuilt, the gates were named after Huldah. So if anyone's been kind of on those like hotel tours, there is a gate that's called Sha'arei Huldah, Huldah's Gate, to commemorate her importance. And a few weeks ago on Shiva Asar B'Tammuz, Meaningful Minute came out with a movie called Mourning with Hope. Did anyone see it? I recommend it this Sunday if you didn't see it a few weeks ago. It was really excellent. It was Shlomo Katz and Goldwicht, E.T.L. Goldwicht, and another rabbi whose name I'm forgetting, who's like Breslov connected. And it was the three of them walking through the old city, telling stories, singing songs. But they started at Sha'arei Huldah. What?
Is it Yaakov Klein?
Yes, Yaakov Klein, Lost Princesses. Yes, yes. Walking through Sha'arei Huldah, talking about mourning with hope. I'm like, oh, this is exactly connected to what I want to talk about, because Huldah was very much about hope, as we're going to see. So Sha'arei Huldah still remain today, even more so a reason for why we have to understand who this lady was. And according to the Midrash, Yirmiyahu prophesied in the streets of Yerushalayim. Tzefaniah prophesied in the Batei Knesset, in the shuls, and Huldah, according to Midrash, which I don't have quoted here, had a school for women in Yerushalayim where she taught Torah as it pertained to the Jewish women, mothers, and daughters. So she was like the woman leader of the generation, which I think is pretty cool. So Huldah is described, we're going to come back to see it inside, but if you look at source number 8, Pasuk Yod Dalet, I said I would be interactive. Does anybody want to read the Pasuk? You can read it in English or Hebrew. No pressure. Okay. Yeah, go, Anna.
I'm really not, like, I'll be the natural Aminata, but I don't want everyone else to jump in. This
I think everyone's happy that you're taking it for the team.
Okay.
You can say it, whatever you want. I do not discriminate. Okay, pause right there. We're actually going to go back to that because that's part of the storyline that we're going to talk about. But by means of introducing who Huldah was, could you read for us Pasuk Yod Dalet, please?
Okay.
14, verse 14 in the same source number
8.
They're very hard, yes.
Shalom,
yes.
Shalom ben Tikva ben Horchas. Shomer Habegadim v'hiyoshevet v'yoshayim v'mishneh.
Okay, so it's a lot of names. I apologize. Thank you for reading it. Not so easy. I wanted to show you how Huldah is introduced to us in the Navi. She's introduced to us as Huldah HaNeviah, right? Eshet Shalom ben Tikva ben Harchas. So she's introduced to us as the wife of Shalom, son of Tikva. So who was Shalom? Important to know too. Huldah's husband Shalom, which comes from the source of Shalom, right? Peace, wholeness. He has a prominent position in the royal court. He was the keeper of the king's wardrobe, in charge of the king's robes and clothes for all occasions. And we know the person who dresses the king gets to kind of see and hear everything that's going on. He was also one of the king's instructors when Hoshea was still a child, so he knew Hoshea's father, Amon, as well. The Midrash relates that Huldah was gifted with Ruach HaKodesh by merit of her husband, who was one of the outstanding individuals of his generation and engage in acts of kindness every day. He was a good man. He would sit at the entrance to the city and would revive any new arrivals by giving them drinks from water. Right? People would do Aliyah LaRegel. They would come, and it's told that Huldah's husband Shalom would sit and give waters to people who came. In addition to her own righteousness, Huldah, as Shalom's life partner, most probably shared his endeavors and was also rewarded for her participation. As a Neviah, she remained connected to Shalom, and both of them really worked together during the time to revive and restore the Jewish people. So Huldah and Shalom were like the power couple of the generation who were very busy doing good things for everybody who came by. Okay, so that's a little background in terms of who Huldah is. So now here's what happened. Some years later, it was the 18th year of Hoshea's reign. He was a young king, so I guess he had a lot of, you know, energy and excitement and optimism. And he decided that he was going to take upon himself or his people the task of restoring the Beis HaMikdash. which had been neglected for so many years. Because remember, we said that the people at the time were really involved in Avodah Zarah. It wasn't a time of people being connected to Hashem. So the prize Beis HaMikdash, which we can't imagine being rejected, because if we had it in our days, and Emir Tzashem, we will soon, we would take good care of it. But at the time, people did not take good care of the Beis HaMikdash. So he called for a mass rally for the purpose of getting the people together to participate in this great undertaking. People responded enthusiastically. The contributions started flowing in. Didn't do like a crowdfunding back then. So however he did, he got the word out and people came with their means, however they could, to help with the restoration project. And the work of repairing and restoring the Beis HaMikdash really was happening under the supervision of another name, the Kohen Gadol at the time, Chilkiah. Chilkiah was the project manager and started in charge of restoring the Beis HaMikdash. So in the midst of the work, as they were working on restoring the Beis HaMikdash, Chilkiah discovered an ancient Sefer Torah from the time of Moshe in the Beis HaMikdash. The unique scroll had been kept in the Kodesh Kedashim of the Beis HaMikdash, but in the time of Avodah Zarah, the kings removed it and hid it in a secret place in the Beis HaMikdash because they didn't want people to come in and get to it. And now, during the restoration project, where they were knocking down walls and cleaning up whatever they were doing, Chilkiah found the Sefer Torah from the time of Moshe. So the Kohen Gadol came with this Torah scroll and he gave it to the king's scribe. Shaphan was the scribe, to take to the king. The king, Hoshea, told Shaphan, the scribe, to read from it. Like, where was it open to? What does it say? And it so happened that as they opened the scroll, it was open to a section in Devarim, in Deuteronomy, where the Tochacha was written. The Tochacha, of course, is where Hashem warns the Jewish people of the terrible consequences that will befall them lest they neglect the Torah and mitzvot, leading to destruction and exile. So you can imagine they're living in that period and they open the Torah to a point that's basically telling them that if you continue doing what you're going to do, what you're doing, if you're going to continue living the way you're living, it's not going to end so well for you. The king was deeply shaken and heartbroken, remembering how his father and grandfather had lived, right? Generations before him died because of their associations with Avodah Zarah. How they desecrated the land with idolatry and evil. He tore his clothes, right, as a sign of mourning, of course, and he ordered Chilkiah, the Kohen Gadol, and four more royal messengers to go to the Nevi'im, to go to the three Nevi'im, and ask them what should they do in view of the divine warning that had just been received. Like, what are we supposed to do with this information? How do we go on from here? What do we do? So that goes back to the first pasuk in source number 8 that Anna was reading. L'chu dirshu et Hashem be'adi uve'adei ha'am uve'ad kol Yehuda al divrei ha-sefer ha-nimtza hazeh ki gdola chemat Hashem asher hi nitzta banu al asher lo shamu avoteinu al divrei ha-sefer hazeh la'asot kechol ha-katuv aleinu. We got to go figure out what to do because these words are not good. Hashem is angry. Now what do we do? How do we clean up this mess that we made? Not the literal mess in restoring the Beis HaMikdash, but in the spiritual mess of our people. What are we supposed to do? How are we supposed to go from here? So Chilkiah went to Huldah. Interesting. They went to the woman first. They went to Huldah and they said, what should we do? What are we supposed to do? So here's what Huldah told them. First look at Pasuk Tet Vav, number 15 in source number 8. Does anyone want to read? I'm also happy to, but happy to give other people the option. Yes. What's your name?
Elka.
Oh, hi, Elka. I did not recognize you. Yes, source type vav in Hebrew or English.
Okay.
If you don't mind. So she says, okay, tell everybody that Hashem is going to bring disaster upon this place. It isn't going to look so good, right? Basically, she's saying whatever is written in the Torah, that's what's going to happen. Okay, pause for a minute. Radak, source number 9, El Chulda HaNeviyah. V'lama halchu el chulda v'lo halchu el Yirmiyahu. Why did Chilkiah, the Kohen Gadol, chose to go to the woman? Why did he go to Chulda and why did he not go to one of the other Nevi'im that was available to help? Yesh mirabotenu, turn the page, zichronam livracha she'amru, right? Chazal say, mipnei shehanashim rachmaniot, because the women are merciful. The women kind of go easy. I'm not going to read this inside, but the bottom part of this Radak is the source for where the different people sat to prophesize. But basically, Radak is saying, yeah, they went to Huldah because she's going to be more merciful. She's going to go easy on them. Now, so far, what we read doesn't sound so easy. Like, she's saying it's going to be bad. But let's go on. Source number 10 is the second part. I kind of divide it into two. So first she says, yeah, this is going to happen. And then look in source number 10. Pasuk Yud Tet. Does anybody want to read it? Anna? Oh, so we have one more in the back. Yeah, go ahead. So she gives a big precursor and she says, but Hoshea, hold on one second. It's not awful because you took this seriously. You saw this decree. You were very concerned. You ripped your clothes. You immediately went into mourning. You came to the Nevi'im. You were clearly energized and concerned enough to want to do something about it. So because of that, Hoshea, Pasukhaf, and I'll read it just for to get us through. Lachain, hineni esoficha el avotecha v'nesafta el kivrotecha b'shalom. Right? I assure you that I will bring you to your fathers and you will be laid to your tomb in peace. You, Hoshea, will die peacefully. V'lo tirena einecha b'chol hara asher ani mevi al hamakom hazeh. You, Hoshea, will not live to see the destruction and everything bad that's going to happen. V'yoshivu et hamelech davar. And they brought that information back to the king. Now, I would argue that that's like not the most positive nevuah. It's still pretty bad. Bad things are going to happen. But the optimism here, or the message of hope here, or the Rachmanias here, is that Hoshea is not going to live to see it. So the Torah goes on, the Malachim goes on to say that the king had everyone gathered around, and he said, here's what happened, here's the situation, we found this Torah, this is what it said, and this is what Huldah said. And what he did actually, Hoshea had a lot of energy, he invigorated, and he was excited about bringing tshuva back to the people, and he actually instigated a tshuva movement where the people of the time actually did do tshuva, and they did say it's time to return back to Hashem. The whole nation reaccepted the covenant. He read the Brit Ben Habdarim out loud, and they accepted it, and under his leadership, with the help of Chilkiah, the nation began to clean up the land of Avodah Zarah, and it really was like the spirit of holiness and tshuva that swept through the nation, a spirit like that that had not swept through the nation for many, many generations before that. And Huldah's prophecy did come true. King Hoshea reigned for another 13 years, and for a total of 31 years. And he did not witness the Chorban Beis HaMikdash or the Chorban Yerushalayim, nor did Huldah. Huldah died before that too. But her prophecy and her influence very much remained an inheritance of the people of that generation, an inheritance of the people of our generation too. In Huldah's lifetime, most of the prophets were warning all about the bad. And again, her prophecy was not overwhelmingly optimistic, but there was a ray of light in it. She could find optimism even during a very dark time. She didn't say people things were bad. She gave the Jewish people and the king something to hope for and work towards. Even those words of Hoshea, you're not going to live to see it, were enough to instigate him to go back to his people to influence the nation to do tshuva. So she, in that clever womanly way, gave the little nudge that the king needed so that he could then go and influence the nation. And so we see from Huldah also, much like we do from Nitzavet, that during dark times, when things are difficult, when things are hard, that message of optimism and hope leads to good things happening. And thinking about the time that we're in, the Bein HaMitzarim, I want to share with you something interesting that my husband just told me about today. He told me that there are a group of Hasidim called Sukachavar Hasidim. I don't know if I'm pronouncing that correctly. Rav Avraham Bornstein, 19th century Poland, had a group of Hasidim called the Sukachavar Hasidim. And in his Shelos Uchuvos on Evan HaEzer, he says that the Hasidim used this time of Bein HaMitzarim to learn Hilchot Yom Tov. And you'd think to yourself, the Beinah Mitzarim, before the 9 days, we should learn Hilchot Avelut, or we should learn the halachas of Lashon Hara, or the halachas of Bein Adam L'Chavero. But no, the Hasidim learned the halachot of Yom Tov. Because he said, Rav Bornstein, from the Sachet Shaver Hasidim, said that they believed that this is a time that we daven for Yeshua. This is a time where we hope for hope. We know that on Tisha B'Av, we believe that Mashiach will be born on Tisha B'Av, right? We talk about Nisan as being the month of Geula and the month that Mashiach will come, although we'll take him whenever he gets here. But that they really use this time to daven and to pray and to learn about the Hilachot of Yom Tov, because they believed that the Mashiach will come, and this is a time that we can turn the potential from Avelut and something difficult into preparing for a Yontif, right? We use the time of Beinah Mitzarim to think of the positivity, to prepare for the good things. And we're running out of time, but there are so many other examples of women specifically, or great people in general throughout our generations, who have really carried that beacon of optimism and hope. And just like Emma said in her share, in the days that we're living, there's so much bad and difficult happening all around us, and it's so easy to succumb to that and to feel down. But what I hope we can learn from the women that we learned about, from both Nitzavet and Huldah, is to look for the optimism, to look for the good, to have the Ayin Tov, and to have the hope. Because ultimately, to have the hope, to be caring and connected to people, as Emma spoke about, these are the things that Be'ezrat Hashem will bring the Geula. Being positive, being hopeful, having an Ayin Tov. So, Emir Hashem, we should just take those ideas, learn from our great women who came before us, and continue to be optimistic, not only for ourselves, but we see it influences those around us. So, thank you very much. You have a question? A comment.